All right, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. Somebody told me, it was purely by accident, that last time I did that, I waited till I said, I'm John Larson, then I gave you the clap signal. So I won't do that anymore, I promise. All right. Well, I've had a hiatus, but I'm tanned, rested, and ready, and ready to get back in the seat. I'm glad to be here with all you lovely people and another lovely panel. First of all, to my left is the amazing Jen.
Hi, Jen. Hi, John. How are you?
Good. Welcome back.
I think you're profiling me, and I'm on all the satanic, demonic podcast. I'm wondering if
by
I'm
choice.
The, yeah, no, did, I know. I didn't
did you
volunteer
see that,
for this one.
What was it, Harvard that was going to have a black mass? And then it got shit canned. So I don't know if this is something that is in the domain of the kind of stuff we work on. Where does one go to get the temple ceremony for a black mass? Norton, do you know where I'd get the black mass? All right. I think you just turn everything upside down, right?
Good to be back.
I do know that there is and I've mentioned it before, everyone needs to go out and see it. I don't think you can stream it from Netflix, but they do have it. The documentary on what's his name? Anton Lavelle? LaVey. Okay, all you Lucifer worshiping people. No. Yeah, Anton LaVey. It's a great documentary. It's tongue in cheek. There's this old chain smoking woman talks about how she lays on the altar naked. It's hilarity from start to finish. But the best part is when the elders tracked out the headquarters of the satanic, the Church of Satan in the middle of this documentary with cameras rolling and poor little guys from Idaho. It's just wonder. It's so delightful. We need to do a screening. As soon as we get a screen up here, we're going to screen that
do
movie.
A screening and then do an episode about it. Commentary.
Yeah.
Or do a Mystery Science Theater 3000 style commentary that you can play along at home.
For sure. We do have actually on the schedule, and Randy, of course, who is the fabulous producer of Mormon Expression. Welcome, Randy.
Thanks.
On the panel.
Good to be here again.
We do have on the schedule for as soon as we get a TV in here, which we have, right? It's on our list. It's on our wish list.
We're getting there.
We are going to do a screening of This Film Is Not Yet Rated, which everyone who leaves the church needs to go see. And you can find out how the MPAA counts thrusts when they decide what's going to be an R or NC-17 rating.
You mean it's arbitrary? It's not prophetically handed down to the MPAA?
No, it's not.
You mean Monson isn't the one? He just, you know, God phones it into him and he just relays it?
Well, you know, when I started watching R-rated, we're already way off into the weeds, aren't we?
Great.
When I started watching R-rated movies, I was about 15, and I looked older, and I could go in and rent movies, and so I decided I saw a couple movies, and they were wonderful. They were life-changing, so I decided I was going to see everything the Academy Award had given award for, so I started with Midnight Cowboy, of course. But they were great, and I realized early on that the most disgusting, degenerate movies were all rated PG-13, and because there was a stigma attached to not having an R rating, you weren't to be taken seriously. So anyway, Laura.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Nice to be here.
It is great to have you here. So we're all here, and we're ready to talk about the news. First of all, I understand that last week there was a great podcast that Lindsay, the wonderful, fabulous, intelligent Lindsay, hosted. And apparently she made a throwaway line in the middle of this podcast. I have not listened to it yet. But she made a throwaway line that she doubted the veracity of the stories that people are having sex on their mission.
That's true.
Okay. All right.
Oh, John.
All of you sick fucks out there need to stop right now sending Lindsay all of your stories of debauchery. The poor girl has been traumatized.
Has she?
Listen, I would have told Lindsay that people are...
She only sees the good.
She only sees the good. But yes, she's got the point that the depravity was there. You don't need to voyeuristically lay all the details out in Lindsay's mailbox anymore. Good. Point taken. We know you were all fucking like rabbits on your mission and doing worse things. Sometimes these things about sex come up, and we haven't discussed them a lot on the podcast because I don't know what the story is there. So you put a bunch of 20-year-olds out on a mission, and they do what 20-year-olds do. I didn't know that was a secret, but I guess it is. When I first arrived at my first apartment as a young missionary, those guys had a surfboard, a wet surfboard. I was in San Diego, of course. The things that happen on missions are legion. We'll leave it there. You don't need to send your six stories to Lindsay anymore.
Yeah,
you got the point.
I believe his major objection is you're sending them to the wrong mailbox. Those are supposed to go to John.
I don't know. Listen,
expression.
All right. This is the era of the internet. Like, I don't need porn sent to me directly. unless I can identify your face in it, then by all means. I'm discreet. I'm a normal person. At least fairly, I guess. What is normal anymore in the days of Google?
You're looking at the wrong girl.
All right. So that's story number one. Stop sending Lindsay your deprived shit. All right. Story number two. This actually happened a couple of weeks ago, but then NPR picked it up this week. Bishop David Heslington, from one of the Salt Lake wards, I didn't see which one it was, has basically pointed out and got national attention from saying, hey, look, all you Republicans, there's a big gap in health care, and there's a lot of members of the church that are served by Obamacare, and the Affordable Care Act is actually helping people out. And he's sort of chiding the local legislators and the local, basically, members of the church, saying, this might not be such a bad thing. I think for a lot of years there's been this sort of arrogance of members of the church in that they tend to say, we take care of our own. And there's a real anti-federal welfare bias. And I think that's well known. And I think what's happened here, why the national press picked this up, is because here you have a Mormon in somewhat of authority, a bishop, who's sort of challenging the Republican status quo. And good on him. Thanks, Bishop Heslington, for doing that. I've heard two interviews with him, and he's very well spoken, and he makes his case very well. And I would hope that some of the arch conservatism here in the state can kind of open their ears a little bit and hear it's not all bad. Nodding your heads does not help.
I always find it interesting when, especially things like the Affordable Health Care Act, where people get so up in arms about it, because isn't this the same organization that basically set themselves up to be communist in the 1840s?
Oh, you don't say that. Mm-hmm. You won't make them happy.
Oh, either. I apologize. That doesn't work either.
What? The Celestial Order.
Yes, that's the proper code word, the Celestial Order.
All right, so our next story, in the ongoing saga of the church trying to dig itself out of a very, very, very big hole, they released a new essay this last week on violence.
I haven't read this one yet.
I just heard it today about it.
I think I may be wrong. But this might be the first time the official church has ever acknowledged the existence of the Danites. They say they were there, but they were very small and don't pay any attention to them, is what they basically said. Here's from the essay, it says, while historical context can help shed light on these acts of violence, it does not excuse them. So they go with the regular apologetic canard that, oh, there's context, you know.
Devil made them do it.
But they say it doesn't excuse them. I mean, that's a progress, right? Good, yeah. What was done here long ago by members of our church represent a terrible and inexcusable departure from Christian teaching and conduct. I think this is the key sentence. Let's take it apart a little bit. First of all, by members of our church still won't take any blame for it, right? The church is still, and we've talked about this in the podcast before, that you are a member of the church and you are part of the church unless you do something that we need to distance ourselves from, and then you're separate from us. The church is not its members. And notice that the essay writers are not dummies. Listen to this. Represent a terrible and inexcusable departure from Christian teaching and conduct, which is debatable, given the Crusades and all that sort of stuff. But notice they don't say from Mormon teaching and conduct, because it was right in line with what was being taught from the pulpit. They knew if they had said that this was a departure from, you know, like things like Mountain Meadows and the Battle of Crooked River and some of those things. They would know this is fully in the realm and control of the brethren of the church. And they can't really distance it that way. But notice the inner working and the sleight of hand that the apologists use. It's beautiful to watch their rhetoric. I same reason I like listening to Rush Limbaugh and listening to how they weave these sentences together on violence. And the whole essay is back and forth, just like that first sentence. We can see the acts, it doesn't excuse them, but da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. They still just won't own it and say, yeah, fuck yeah, we were kicking ass.
Shouldn't there be like some sort of logical fallacy that's like, I'm not responsible because it's historical or something like that?
Yeah, it undermines the whole principle of the restoration, right? The more because the church that got restored was the thing that was most directly touched by God. You know, we can say, well, it's been 170 years now since Jesus himself came, but the battles in Missouri were like the sacred grove was still glowing at that time, right? There was still like fallout. The Geiger counters would go off, right? and it's really hard to say, here we are at the source with Joseph himself leading it, and oh, well, that was just culture, you know?
I don't know, though. I think it falls in line with what they've been doing a lot lately, which is kind of softballing some of the issues with the early church, but they present it in such a way where, oh, yeah, it happened, but it really had nothing to do with any official church leadership. It was just a bunch of people kind of going rogue a little ways, and, you know, Joseph couldn't control his people back then, so.
Well, you're absolutely right. What the apologists and sort of liberal Mormons call this is inoculation, which right there, battle over. If whatever it is you're arguing for has to be inoculated, you know, like, we don't inoculate against, like, awesomeness. It's always against, like, the mumps, you know. If you have to inoculate people against what you believe, it's time to find a new set of beliefs. But that aside, you know, they want to slip these things out. Now they can say, oh, see, we've been talking about the Danites. It's right there on our website, even though it's in a throwaway sentence.
Yeah, well, it's been acknowledged, so case closed. We don't need to talk about anything beyond that because we gave you the whole story.
Is it so that it will come up on web searches as well? So nothing is coming up on LDS.org now if someone's looking up the Danites, but then this week that's going to show up in the engine?
I think that's true, you know, because they're obviously, the church does really sophisticated link farming and all that. So I think you're absolutely right, and that's one of the reasons they want to get higher up. But more importantly, they just had no response to most of the attacks over the past 40 or 50 years. And in the past, what they did is they marginalized, and it was really nutty evangelicals on corners hanging out these mimeographed, stapled together things, and they were easy to ignore. And now with the weight of the internet, you have a lot of this material that's very present, and the church has they've lost the war already. I mean, let's be clear. And now they're just doing a desperate measure to try to even acknowledge these things. I mean, if you think about it, they're not really giving any argument against it. They're just acknowledging that it happened at this point. There's not really a good justification for the violence, and it's all over the map. Oh, it was culture, and it was their product of their times, and da da da. But to your point, Jen, one of the favorite defenses of the apologists, and next week's podcast, we'll be delving more into apologetics. But one of their favorite things is, oh, we've already dealt with that. This is the most common response you'll get from believers or apologists. Oh, we've already talked about that. As if they published something in the Farms Review of Books in 1986, the case is closed, you know. But that's their most common defense. It's already been dealt with.
Right.
So I think this just falls into that line of thinking.
I agree.
All right, so that's the news. It was a slow news week, I guess.
You missed a story from the news.
Oh, did I?
This is probably the biggest news because, you know, my current alma mater, I said that totally wrong.
Yeah.
So UVU sent out a press release, which last week on Tuesday, and they named Dallin H. Oaks as an honorary fellow. It's big news.
Whoa. I guess it's news in that now people are paying attention to this. I mean, the brethren have been sitting on all these boards, board of directors, for a long time. The way board of directors work
is fellow a board of director?
Well, all these sort of honor these
That's
are these sort of honor, but they work the same. I mean, the same point's going to be made.
Okay,
which is all these positions that you hear about, they're all for sale. And this is not a secret, right? Matter of fact, if you call up the university and say, hey, I want the library named after my father, they'll say, please hold. And they'll check your credit score, and then they'll connect you to the right person, and they'll give you an amount.
We wait for the check to come in before we name anything.
People who sit on board of directors for nonprofits are there because they can bring big money in, and they can bring prestige and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I think actually the latter thing, which you said, there's more, I think, where the bigger story is in here, because having grown up in Utah County and graduated from UVU, they kind of have always had this brand of they're BYU light or they're, you know, the anti-BYU school that's still in Utah. And ever since they brought Holland's son in as president of the university, and it's 5-6 years ago when they went to university status, while going there and seeing stuff, there's this kind of slowly ramping up where they're really almost trying to give themselves an image of being an alternative to BYU on par with them instead of the bridge to BYU because my grades weren't good enough, I couldn't get in, or I'm a little bit too rebellious, which is actually a pretty big culture shift at that university from back when it was still the state college, when it was UVSC before.
Yeah, and I'm older than you are, so I remember when back in the old days when we would get off the freeway and drive through cherry orchards to get down to BYU. At that time it was a community college. And it's really a product of two things. BYU capped its student body. So there were still people who wanted to come to Provo for various reasons. And BYU, the getting into BYU, especially during the 90s, was ramping up higher and higher and higher and higher. You had to have higher scores and because it was really in high demand. And then...
Well, and that was also in direct competition to the University of Utah that was raising their admission standards as well.
Yeah, there's always been a tension between those two flagship schools. And then there was a lot of runoff from people who wanted their kids to come to BYU to meet a spouse. And
your spouse has boobs.
No, was I gesturing?
That's great.
And then let's not forget that in 1993, when there was the academic purging, there were quite a few professors, pretty notable professors like Eugene England, who left BYU and went to UVU. So suddenly there was a spike in the quality of their faculty, and UVU was able to sort of use that and these guys' connections a little bit. So there's really the two-pronged growth of UVU, and it's a fairly big school now. The most fascinating thing about the school by far is that they built all their buildings together. So if you go to one end of campus, you can walk to the other end of campus and never go outside. That's its hallmark.
It's very nice on when there's blizzards going on outside.
And it has a very sort of Soviet cement aesthetic that's very appealing to some, I guess.
It's because they started out in their original iteration as a technical college,
so all
of their architecture is based around it. But I do think that this really, it's kind of a story that's been gathering over years, but it is, in my view, them kind of working to make their image as we are an extension of BYU rather than we're not like that school down the street. And I'd go back to when I first started, I took a philosophy class, and the best quote I ever got from the class was my professor, who also taught at BYU, said, I actually really like coming here because when I come here, when I go to BYU, I have to teach them all how to think. When I come here, I just have to teach you guys how to have some morals.
Yes, because UVU and Florida State, those two schools, they're
hand
just
in hand,
tearing the country to pieces.
You got to rein them in.
They have direct lines to Columbia, like tunnels. You go, No. You've used a good school. If you go there, you'll see that the big building there says McKay on it. The McKay their stadium
was. The event's not anymore.
And then if you go to other buildings, you see Hinckley, and the naive person would say, "Oh, look, the schools name all of their buildings after the prophets." This is not true. The schools sell naming rights to very wealthy, powerful families.
And to that, it's not the McKay Event Center anymore. It's now the UCCU Event Center, and McKay and his statue got demoted to the Education Building, which is the old elementary school out north of the campus. It's not connected to anything. So obviously they haven't upped their donation
the
for
McKay
a while.
The McKay family might be slipping, but yeah, this is actually fairly well known in Utah. I think a lot of Mormons outside don't realize this, but these families, these names that you see oftentimes, the McConkeys, the McKays, the Hinckleys, it's not by chance that you pass Hinckley car dealerships and stuff like that. They're powerful families that have a lot of money, and it doesn't necessarily come from the church. It came from their outside endeavors, which of course all trace back to the church. So there you go.
Pre-tax.
All right. Any other news stories that I missed?
No.
Okay. Tonight, we're going to talk a topic that has been on my list of podcasts to talk about for a long time. And it might be one of those phrases that I throw around quite a bit. I was recently traveling. I was in the United Kingdom, and some of the people I was able to meet up with people there. It was very wonderful, but they were teasing me about some of the things I say all the time that don't make sense to anybody but me. And this might be one of them, the grand demonic conspiracy.
It for sure is, because when I Googled it, the only thing Google found was that Mormon Expressions was doing a podcast on
it.
John coined phrase.
I think I coined it. I don't know that I stole it from anybody. The grand demonic conspiracy is an element that surfaces and just boils under the surface of Mormonism. And it's not talked about as explicitly as we're going to talk about it tonight, but I want you all to see as we get through the evening that it does in fact influence everything, and it influences the way that Mormons encounter the world in a way that's mostly harmless but can be very, very dangerous. And we have seen this sort of thing happen before in human history. When you look at, for example, the Spanish Inquisition, is it Goodwin's law to bring up the Spanish Inquisition? Does that count also?
I think we should make a term for it. We could call it Larson's law.
I was being teased about the Mormon expression. Drinking game, and my violation of Goodwin's law is in fact a square on there. But the Nazis they had such wonderful style. I mean, in dress. I mean, it's a shame because they knew how to make a war uniform, right? And it's terrible that they did all these other things. And it's an injustice to many, many things, of which very low on the list is fashion. my priorities are not mixed up, but they knew how to dress officers, God damn it. Look at those guys in their jack boots. It's so sexy. All right.
Oh, wow.
So, there's nothing wrong with jack boots.
I was about to Google it. I don't even know what they look like.
Oh, okay. So the grand demonic conspiracy. First of all, in almost every organization, there needs to be a them. There needs to be an other. And when I talk about organization, I'm really talking about kind of the way humans think, the way humans divide up the world. There's always us and there's always them. There is the enemy. There's the other. There's the people that are outside that are not us. And once you establish that, you always have to come up with a narrative as to why they're not us. Now, if you're divided on something like race or language, it's easy. Like the term barbarian from the Romans. The term meant bar. It meant to babble. That's what the barbarians came from. They were babbling. They didn't understand what the hell they were saying. So when you have people who can't even speak, well, they're easy to demonize. When you have people who are the wrong color, people who don't look the way you do, people who dress incorrectly, they obviously have something wrong in their head. And it's a real normal human tendency. Not a good one. It's a normal human tendency.
It doesn't have to be that complex. You can tell children that they're on the red team and the other half of the class is on the blue team. And all of a sudden, their hormones shift and they're rallying around the reds. And it can be that simple. It's that much a part of human nature.
And it happens quickly, right?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of stuff written about it. I think the greatest book... now my mind went blank, about the Stanford prison experiments, the Lucifer effect. And a fascinating book. I know I mentioned it before, but because the Dr. Zimbardo? I want to say Zamboni, but isn't that like a...
That's the thing that goes
that's
on the
Zamboni.
Ice.
Yeah, Zamboni. He really puts the reflection on him and how he fell into this as a doctor of psychology. Even he fell prey to this of assuming that role and turning your enemy into a demon. So with religion, that demonic effect is real in that... They really believe that they're demons, and a demon would be something that is the ultimate evil. You take whatever you can imagine as being all the negative traits in the world, and you personify them, and you boil them down to their essence. That's what you're going to put on the devil, right? And the devil and the devil's minions. Be it a femininity that you're scared of, you're going to label it as witchcraft. Be it science that you don't understand is wizardry. And it's all this thing that is the other and to be feared.
Well, and it had a role to play. I mean, there was a lot about the world that if we go back in time to when, you know, civilizations really starting to come up and religions at its power most powerful, there are a lot of things that people don't understand about reality. And it was a lot easier sometimes to just find something to say, well, it's just a demon, right, that does that. That's just how it, you know, they live there and they do their thing and we just got to deal with it. It's part of this other reality that just underlies our own. So it was really a natural thing for people to latch onto to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely, because to me it's not hard to explain the nature of evil or where evil comes from. It's us. We're evil by nature and we're good by nature. We do both things. We're as human beings, you can see it in us all the time. But humans have not been settled with that. And we tend to see the good in us and the evil in them. And that helps when you have to kill people or steal their cattle or whatever else you can take from them. It's better if you turn them into something that's less than human. So that power, I think that draw is in our genetics, and it's very strong. So in Christianity and other religions of the book in particular, Eastern religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, they also have a concept of the devil, but it's not nearly as strong as it is in Christianity. It's not nearly as powerful. And oftentimes in other religions, the devil-y figures are more tricksters. They're in there just trying to screw things up just because they're funny, as opposed to coming from this real motivation of pure evil. And really in Christianity we've pushed it to a level of ridiculousness that to me is self-evident that it's not real. But
so in preparation for this, I picked up one of the go-to books that I think everybody who is just trying to get a better idea how the world function in general, but especially leaving a religion, should read, because it doesn't talk about religion, but only talks about religion, which is The Demon-Haunted World, Science is a Candle in the Dark by Carl Sagan. So yes. I'm probably going to quote mine a lot of stuff out of that as we go along, because I think it's got some stuff. But in the first section, and this is the chapter of The Demon-Haunted World, he talks about Plato, which goes back pretty far back. And Plato, according to this, says, he stoutly denied that demons were a source of evil and represented Eros, the keeper of sexual passions, as a demon, not a god. Neither mortal nor immortal, neither good nor bad. But all later Platonists, including the Neoplatonists, who powerfully influenced Christian philosophy, held that some demons were good and others evil. The pendulum was swinging. So he kind of talks about how originally demons were just kind of used as an explain for mechanism of things we didn't understand. But as Christianity came about, it kind of began to have this thing where it morphed, which may go to where you're saying. In Christianity, over time, they definitely get much more association with, you know, an evil entity or devil.
Oh, for sure. And the devil is surprisingly missing from the Bible, especially the Old Testament. He makes a guest appearance in my favorite book, Job. but he's kind of the hero of that story, isn't he? He's like the good guy, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Because he's right. He's right that God's kind of a dick. I think that's the point he was trying to make, right? That's the way I read Job. I may be using the wrong translation. Not reading King James as much.
Well, as I understand it, the Satan, the word where we get Satan from, was like Hebrew for, it was like lawyer, it was advocate. And because that's the thing, this character that we're talking about, the devil, does not come up in the Bible. You know, there's a lot of characters that are called the devil. Christians retroactively say, well, that's the devil. But if you parse them out, they're all different characters. Sometimes it's just a guy who's just kind of goofing with God's business. But like in the case of Job, he's not a bad guy. He's testing, you know, God's operation.
Right.
It's not oppositional. It's part of the operation.
Well, we steal the names of gods of people who live around us, like Baal or Beelzebub or those sort of things, or their euphemisms. Lucifer is the son of light or the son of morning or whatever it is. And really, you know, the snake, the narrative in the New Testament or in Genesis, it doesn't really ever say that it's the devil. It just says it's the snake. And then there's a lot of metaphor that happens in the revelation of the crazy Saint John, where, you know, we start making these connections with dragons and all this other stuff. But a lot of the lore and understanding that we have about devils and demons and all that kind of stuff is much later than the Bible, and it doesn't really take root strongly until the late Middle Ages.
Yeah, and that actually goes along in Demon Haunted World. Carl Sagan makes an argument that if you go through the history, basically the concept of this evil spirits of demons and stuff was really a way to begin that distancing of Christianity from the pagan roots where a lot of the people came from. Because demons were just, there were good ones, there were bad ones, they just were there. But there is a quote, So St. Paul says in Ephesians 6:14, talking about wickedness in high places, where it reads, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principles, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." And he makes the argument that he was referring more directly to demons rather than to, you know, say, corrupt religious leaders or something like that.
Yeah, and what's fascinating, if you go to medieval churches or cemeteries or whatever, you'll see a lot of the symbology that we associate with Satanism today is all over, especially icons of death. They're beautiful. There's all the cherubim stroking skulls and crossbones, and they're just replete. But those weren't symbols of the devil at all. Now, of course, we have Dante, who probably did more to shape. And of course, I don't want to give credit to Dante. He was capturing what the zeitgeist of the time was. He didn't make all that shit up. And during the Middle Ages, you have a really, really crappy way of living. Like, life is just awful, right? And death is ever present. And we're still trying to get people to behave. People weren't as religious during that time as Catholic leaders would have us believe. So if you want to, if you live in, if you're not a king, so you're covered in shit all the time, right?
Isn't that it? Yeah, that pretty much covers it.
If you live in that, I have on the schedule to do a whole podcast on why Mormons are fascinated with Monty Python and the Holy Grail. But that's, I digress. If you live a really shitty existence, and you need to be scared of hell, you got to turn hell into a pretty terrible place. Because, you know, if you're living in Italy in 1274, it's not like this is a really wonderful way to live your life. So we start getting these pumped up symbols, and the power and influence of the devil starts to grow and grow and grow and grow. And then when you start getting like the Inquisition and some of the Counter-Reformation movements, by this time you're starting to look at all of this thing is being under the influence of the devil, and these people as being servants of the devil, and this idea of witchcraft and Judaism and all these different things that didn't mark what we defined as the straight and narrow. Now, whenever you get away from the church, you start getting more of this. And with the exception of the time period of the Reformation and the Inquisition, churches usually were spending their time combating a lot of the folk sort of witchcraft and that sort of stuff. Now, it's interesting, when we get out to the United States, the people get out ahead of the churches. The church doesn't have as many clerics. They don't have as much influence. And you start entering more of this folk magic sort of stuff. And the Puritans, this country would have been so much better if it had been established by those fucking Puritans. They're really... Get a big thing for witchcraft, right? And so this starts bleeding into the consciousness that Joseph Smith kind of came into. So by the time Joseph Smith comes into Mormonism, we really have the devil as being a real and scary figure. Now we know that Joseph Smith, that this concept of sort of black magic versus white magic was still around. I mean, he practiced all sorts of elements of the occult. That's well understood. And I don't think Joseph Smith ever would have seen himself as a devil worshiper or as something who is practicing or in cahoots with the dark forces. But it was there, and that's the point I'm leading up to.
When he was searching for treasure, what do you think he thought? He had some power that was coming from God, or that he... Do you think it was all fake?
So from an anthropological point of view, the difference between magic and religion is, for religion, we implore the gods to do something. For magic, we manipulate symbols and make it happen ourselves. So there was definitely elements of what Joseph Smith and family were doing. For example, they had a holy dagger, and they would draw symbols on paper or on the ground, do incantations, say magic words to try to make things happen. So usually people who practice magic don't believe that. So if I go and say magic words over the magic bread that is representing the body of my dead savior or whatever, that I'm still... that's not magic, because I'm imploring God to do something to intervene, as opposed to that if I say these words in Latin and I cut this thing up a certain way, it's going to happen intrinsically. So Joseph Smith clearly believed in magic, but I don't think he was believing the way that like evangelicals or even Mormons would interpret it today, is that there's no such thing as magic. It's just when you're doing those things, you're calling the devil,
yeah,
and then the devil does that.
That's what I would think. Today, we would think that was more... devil worship.
And a big part of it is, too, is when you look, when they were into that, most of it, it was before the church was even a thing. I mean, he was going upon the more traditional folk magic that he'd been taught living out there. I mean, not only did they, you know, do the dagger and stuff, but, you know, seer stones. He talks about using the seer stones to search for treasure, you know, and then other times they'll talk about how they would, I read a history somewhere about how him and his dad and a bunch of other people would go out and search for treasures, and they'd have to basically set up a 5-point star around where the treasure was supposed to be and have incantations and then dig for it, and would talk about how sometimes when they didn't find it, it's because, well, some slippery demon came and pulled it down further into the earth. You know, they didn't get there fast enough.
Yeah, and that's in the Book of Mormon too, right? That which is a common folk belief. If you can't find the treasure, it disappears into the ground. And Joseph Smith put that right in the book.
Well, and also, I mean, the practice of medicine all the way up until about 1900 was pretty much magic.
Yeah,
it worked the same way. It was just people trying to manipulate. You know, they thought, oh, this plant does the magic thing. If you do this, you know, whatever. Like, when you look at the things they sell you, like, you have diarrhea, well, go swallow this thing and dance around the fire at midnight, you know? And that was medicine.
Yeah, yeah. And if you think about it, we still do, for the Catholics, they still do Hail Marys and things like that are very rote. And in the Mormon church, we do something similar. Well, you need to go read your scriptures every morning and work your way through the entire Book of Mormon. And so the bishop will give you this magical prescription that if you do all these things, then you'll somehow please the gods.
I think what's convenient for all these folks that are defining the faith and the religions of the time, I mean, like Joseph Smith, is that they could give God and the devil equal power in the faith, and then they could say that the power they were using, or you know, whatever spiritual magic that they were performing, was from God. Yet someone else that was doing the same thing, they could say was being influenced by Satan. And they use that today still in Mormonism and other Christian religions, that if you're not the folks that are in power, or you're doing something absurd that they're not into, then they can assign that to the devil or Satan or demon. Yet yes. What they're doing can be assigned to God.
And you hear the word counterfeit come up, and I want to come back to that a little bit. I think you're absolutely right. And that was Joseph Smith's first real crisis of authority, is when the church was first set up, it was a church of prophets, that we were all getting this prophecy, and whatever the girl's name is, I can't remember anymore, that she had a seer stone, and she was getting revelation also, and Joseph had to stamp that one down right away.
Oh yeah, really quick, I had to step in and assert that why his authority and his visions were legit, but her visions were not.
So. Absolutely. And the church still has that issue and that problem today, because it tells people, oh, you're entitled to this. If you fast and you pray and you do this, then, hey, you're going to be entitled to this, but you can't have anything that contradicts what we say, what the authority says. So it's a constant tension. So in the temple, there's the devil keeps sneaking around, and he's the most flamboyant character there, and the best dressed, obviously.
Best dressed, most entertaining.
Yeah. And the devil claims at one point, and he turns. So you'll have to remember that the temple was a passion play, and so the characters are interacting with each other, but the devil breaks the fourth wall, and he turns to the audience, and he says, if these people in these temples this day do not live up to every covenant they make, it's been a while, if they do not make up to, if they do not, help me out, guys, here.
If they do not,
if they do not basically live up to every covenant they make at these altars in these temples
this day,
then they shall be in my power.
And then you kind of hear, don't you hear thunder at that moment?
Then Lex de Alzevedo bangs the kettle drum.
Yes.
And it gives that nefarious smirky smile.
One eyebrow goes up.
And did you get
Michael,
it right?
Michael Balaam.
The devil is the best character in the temple, and the devil says very clearly that if you do not obey this stuff, then you'll be in my power. And oh my God, we have the audio.
This glory. Now you are to take possession of the holiest. I have a word to say concerning these people. If they do not walk up to every covenant they make at these altars in this temple this day, they will be in my power.
Is it just me, or did he lisp?
I was thinking more, it sounded like the dialogue right out of a 1970s episode of Doctor Who.
It has that feel, right? You're waiting for a guy in a rubber suit to come waddling over from
definitely
stage right. Okay, so that's what happens.
Mormon Expression is a listener-funded program. If you like what you hear, please visit us at mormonexpression.com and consider becoming a subscribing member. While you're there, let us know what you think about the show.
Darwin published his book in 1859.
I really should know somewhere this.
Around there. I'm waiting for everybody to pull out their little smartphones.
You were the one that was just in London.
I was
reading
just,
all of it.
I had my picture taken with the Grand Master,
yeah,
didn't I?
Yeah, it was good.
This is not long after the church was born, and the church has been dealing with the ramifications of science ever since, and the fossils and the fossil record and science in general. that the church has had to be combating almost from day one, from 20 or 20, 30 years after the church was founded. And it's been difficult. It's hard. I feel sorry for the church a lot because they picked the wrong century to start a religion, right? This was supposed to happen like in 2400 BC. That's when you start a religion. You don't do it after the printing press.
It was my my favorite quote from my microbiology professor, where we could never figure out if he was just former Mormon or still active, but really liked to get the Mormon kids riled up. But he talked about how, in comparison, germ theory came about in the 1830s, the same time supposedly we've got Joseph and all these revelations, and his saying is always, and I'm going to do my really horrible impression, I know I've done this once before, but he says, these guys are getting this information about the germs, and Joseph and a Brigham, they're getting their revelation. Tell me, who has the real revelation? But it makes a point, right? There are so many scientific things that come up that if they really were this direct conduit to God, why did Joseph Smith not be the originator of germ theory?
Well, at BYU, they told me that Joseph Smith issued in the era of Enlightenment.
Oh.
They missed that the Enlightenment actually happened in the 18th century.
Oh,
but no, this is a really common belief by Mormon intellectuals that they argue that Joseph Smith inaugurated a new age of discovery. Unfortunately, every discovery contradicts the religion that Joseph Smith himself put in, but that's just a small point. So you have all this troublesome information. And I was told at BYU by Dr. Matheny, he was a great anthropology professor that I had down there, that he wouldn't tell us what authority it was, but that one of the church higher-ups came and told him that all the fossils that they had in the building there were a lie. They were a demonic conspiracy. They were a demonic falsification. And in Mormonism, why I call it the grand demonic conspiracy is this idea that the devil is influencing things. It becomes extremely extensive. And it's used as a sort of the universal constant. Is that too obscure? It's used as a variable to make your equation work out correctly when it doesn't work out correctly on its own. It's the luminous ether. It's the thing out there that you can use to discount any piece of evidence. And it has been used extensively. Logic is the tool of the devil. Science is the tool of the devil.
Feminists.
Oh my God. Women. Yeah, for sure. and it's anything that comes in contradiction with the main line that we're saying can quickly just be dismissed by saying this is demonic, this is devilish. Even things that are silly, like rock and roll, right? If people don't understand it, it's got a beat that they can't quite get their hands around, it's got to be devilish, right? Because I don't understand it. It doesn't speak to me. You know, the old conflict that's not old, it's still going on, where the church is spreading in Africa, but they won't let the drums in because drums are... make me feel funny. When I hear the drums, I feel funny. So it must be the devil, right? And so you start seeing the devil absolutely everywhere.
Well, and there's a lot of precedence for that, especially if you go back to the early church. I mean, you can go back to the first source of, you know, the first vision where Joseph talks about, you know, the devil having control and the darkness enclosing on him, and, you know, he starts praying, goes away. But my favorite story is, some years later, after the church has been established, Joseph and a bunch of guys are out on him doing some mission work, going out probably looking for Indians. And they're rafting down a river, and their boat gets flipped over, right? And I think probably Joseph was at the helm, so he felt a little embarrassed. But he says, no, it wasn't us. I saw a demon on the water. A demon flipped the boat over. And that, as far as that best I can tell, is the origination of why missionaries can't swim in the water. Because he said, no, we can't travel upon the water because the water is the realm of the devil, because he flipped a boat over and was embarrassed about it.
Well, and then he went and bought passage on a coach.
Yeah.
The others had to walk.
I didn't know that part of the story. That makes it even better.
You can look it up. I didn't make it up. So you start using this excuse over and over again, and it starts building. and building and building and building. And you're using it, like Randy just pointed out, to explain what's going on right here in the immediacy. Oh, it's the devil, it's the devil, it's the devil. But then you take a couple steps back and you realize what you've done is you've constructed a theology in which you place the devil in everything. I've wanted to go through and do a podcast at some point, I probably will, that tells you with every branch of science, and it is every branch of science, how one of their major tenets disagrees fundamentally with Mormonism. And that there's none that are compliant with Mormonism at all. And the only way you can make that work is to use my Franken BYU professor and never put the guy together, so you never look at more than a section of it. Of course, my Franken BYU professor is, if you took a BYU professor and just cut out the part of him that had to do with whatever he or she was expert in, and you sewed them all together, you'd have a professor who believed nothing of the Mormon Church. Because if you're a linguistics professor, you don't believe anything the church says about linguistics. If you're a physics professor, you don't believe anything the church says about physics. And if you took all those together and synthesized them into one professor, there'd be nothing left of the church. So in order to deal with that, you have to start coming up with these creative, uninformed and semi-coherent explanation, saying that it's the devil that is screwing everything up. Now let's go back. That's one of the phrases that is on the bingo game, by the way. Let's go back to the beginning with the plan of salvation. So in the original Genesis story of the Garden of Eden, it's a great myth. It's a beautiful story, and it works on many, many levels. But when the Mormons come along, Mormons aren't unique to do this, but it's key to Mormon theology, and put the devil in instead of the snake, they make a huge theological mess that most Mormons ignore. The theological mess, and I know I pointed this out before, is that if the devil wanted to thwart the plan, he would simply do nothing and the whole thing falls down. Right? He just goes and plays pinochle, right? Because the whole system is dependent upon the devil continuing to act. Because the Book of Mormon tells us that man is not free to act. He has to be compelled one way or the other. And we're told that in the interest of free agency, God does not compel man to act. This guy's a real douche, right? Have I made that clear over the years?
So only the devil can influence us.
Right.
That is what you're saying.
Yeah. That's what they... Don't try to make too much sense of it. But so you allow the devil to run rampant in the system, because if God's standing up here and not saying things and the devil is just chooses to do nothing, then we all just wander into walls and bump into one another. Like, we don't really do anything because we are not free to act.
I always found that the thing most interesting about the temple, and I don't know, maybe you can shed a little light on this, is as they're going through that whole narrative and the devil comes into the story, the first thing that happens is, you know, the devil goes in and influences Eve, and then it's God comes down and he's basically like, you, what are you doing? Why are you giving this, right? And all he looks at God and he says, paraphrasing, all I'm doing is what has been done on the worlds before this. And then God basically condemns him for it, and you can just see the devil like has this confused look where like, dude, this was the deal. I was supposed to come down and do this. Why are you doing it? Or like,
he's right.
He was
right?
Doing it preemptively, and he's not the person that was supposed to do it, or what? Like, I never quite understood that aspect. And then why the devil wants to take out people for being mad at God changing the deal.
He wants
never
people
quite
to be
understood.
Miserable like him.
Yeah,
right. Is what the Mormon.
If he's just doing what essentially, I mean, basically, if I'm going to put my words into the devil's mouth, it's like, well, dude, I'm just doing what we do here, right? We this is the next thing we do. I'm just speeding the process along,
right? Because let's point again about how dumb God is here. Let's say you have a big an estate. What's that show everybody? You're Downton Abbey. What's the name? Who's in charge?
I don't know.
I'm the lord of the manor, And I have a gardener who's a really sick guy who wants to molest children all the time. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take him away from his gardens and I'm going to banish him to the nursery because that's where I'm going to put all the kids. Why does God banish the devil to the earth? Does that make any sense?
Well, I think a Mormon would tell you because in order for God to be good, there needs to be an opposite in all things.
Right.
So we have to have the devil because there needs to be opposition in all things. But I kind of feel like I've been looking into this, I feel bad for Satan, which is weird, but I'm like, God made him to do this,
right?
And he's doing what he's supposed to do.
I only feel bad for him because he's a tool. because the answer is simple. He's just going to sit down and say, you do not want to eat that fruit. No, I'm telling you, do not eat the fruit, right? And then everybody's getting impatient up in heaven. Man, it's been 7 billion years. What the fuck's going to happen? And they just don't eat the fruit. You know, whatever you do, let's go over and play Ring Around the Rosie. Just don't eat the fruit. This would be somebody who really wants to thwart God's plan, right? Not do exactly what God wants him to do and be the bad guy. Well, I mean, why? If he observed this happening in other worlds...
You think he'd know how this ends?
Yeah, he's read
him.
The last chapter of the book. It doesn't end well for him. He shouldn't go on that route. But so we've gone to the plan of salvation. We've cooked the devil into this whole scheme. And what we've made it so is that if you really believe this and you buy into it, you can't believe anything. The entire world is beyond the fog of war. The metaphor I'm going after is in every video game where you play, the fog of war blacks out where you can't see on the screen. So it's not, I'm not using like a Winston Churchill term or anything. It's about video games. So nothing can be trusted. You can't trust anything from any of your college professors. You can't trust anything you read. You can't trust basic logic.
Here there be dragons.
Absolutely.
It's the edge of the map.
And then so you get to a point where all of these systems, from economics to Judaism to whatever else is out there, can be and is guided by the devil. Everything becomes extremely scary at this point. Nothing can be trusted at all.
Confusing, hard to discern, because God has similar power. So when you're teaching your kids, don't invite the devil in. You're also saying invite the Holy Ghost in. And I think that's where a lot of us get really fucked up in Mormonism, is we're raised confused about the messages that we're getting, because I feel good, but is that the spirit of God or is that the spirit of Satan? And gosh, that song makes me feel the same way that boy did, you know, choose the right and making out are giving me the same funny feeling. It's like, wait a minute, like God and Satan
give me the same feeling. Those are different feelings.
It's like hard to discern. And like, you're right. So you don't know what reality is, who's in charge of what, and you're taught from the very beginning not to be skeptical about either. You need to believe in both powers, and they're both heavy, and they both mean everything, and your afterlife is going to depend on who you accept in and who you push out. And
now what I find fascinating by believers is that they can keep this tension, because this tension collapses the entire system for me. When you see Joseph Smith going and trying to get the copyright to the Book of Mormon sold in Canada, and then it fails, and then he says, some revelation from God, some are from the devil. What are you going to do? Or you get the brethren saying, well, we were just a bunch of racist bigots, and we couldn't tell the difference. We couldn't tell the difference between our own racist nonsense and God. People like me say, well, why the fuck should I listen to you on anything at all? If you miss the big ones, I mean, look at all the big social movements of the mid-19th century. Slavery? No, missed that one. Women's rights? Missed that one. Economics? We were way off on economic theories. Social order? Nah, social order wasn't that good. Environmentalism? No. You can just go on and on and on and on that the church generally is on the wrong side of history because generally they mark themselves conservative. A word about conservatism. I know there's a lot of people who are happy to call themselves conservatives, probably a few in this room. But isn't this always wrong? I mean, if you pick any 100-year period dating back to 10,000 years ago and say, were the conservatives right or were the progressives right? Aren't the conservatives always wrong?
There was a good quote in a book my wife's reading. I believe it was Billions and Billions, wasn't it? Another Carl Sagan book where he talks about conservatives and he sums it all up in basically one line. He says, they call themselves conservative, but what exactly are they conserving?
Yesterday's good idea. When you have that, when there's a fundamental fear of progress there, there's a fear that progress is somehow wrong and it's always leading us to hell in a handbasket. And this idea that it's the devil who's bringing progress about becomes a way to avoid the entire mess. But it creates this huge problem, and it's a problem of ignorance. There's a reason that fundamentalism tends to be abandoned by the intellects and left with people who aren't as so much. So, did I just call everybody to church dumb? I didn't mean to do that. I was a believer for a long, long time. So there's a
lack of skepticism there, I think, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you are not intellectual or studious or educated or however you want to say it. But
it's a lack of critical thinking skills is really what it is. I'm employed as a teacher right now in a highly Mormon area, and I teach biotechnology. And even in kids that have this grasp of this, you know, pretty high-level science for their age, critical thinking skills just go out the window because it's not a culture that fosters or develops them.
Right.
I also work in education and I've got a lot of...
Sorry, where are we on now? I also work in education. I've got a lot of LDS colleagues that I respect a lot, and I respect their intelligence, but you know, and it just kind of blows me away how intelligent they are, but there's this key component of their lives that they just can't, that they won't apply the same kind of critical thinking that they expect their students to do in class when they're reading texts. I think it's just being able to compartmentalize, and part of it probably is this idea of Satan. Well, I'm not going to go there because Satan's going to tempt me.
That's the key. That's the point of tonight. It's something that even the very elect, even the most intelligent people can use to not have to deal with stuff because they can say, no, that's the devil tricking you. Because and this is why religion trains people to rely on their feelings and to rely on authority and their emotional connection between the two. And that's the circle jerky sort of system they get. You know, I'm really down on circle jerks in this podcast rhetorically more than I am so in real life. I just want to put that.
So everyone take note. Those emails.
I need to be more careful with my metaphors because sometimes I am unduly prejudiced against things that don't deserve any prejudice.
You're looking to me for a comment on that, and I'm not going to make one.
this stuff can be used in a very dangerous way. The thing that's really dangerous is we've seen historically when this stuff explodes, when we start going after witches, when we start going after infidels, because if our loved ones leave the church and it doesn't make any sense, the little brother of this demonic conspiracy is, oh, they wanted to sin, and sin is caused by the devil. They were offended. Those feelings are caused by the devil. What people basically believe is once somebody decides to leave the church, they no longer have to be treated fully like a human because they're not behaving like a human anymore. Their emotions and their thoughts are now under control of the devil. Mormons oftentimes treat, in their mind, whether consciously or unconsciously, apostates as the possessed. And once somebody is possessed, they're no longer human. Human compassion and where we started at the beginning of the podcast, the us and them, you are the them, and you're worse than the them, because the infidel is that way because they've always been that way. They're the Lamanites. I mean, look at the way the Book of Mormon sets it up. The Lamanites, it's the traditions of their fathers. But the Nephites who turn, what's the 24 priests, those guys, they're the awful ones. They're the real wicked ones. So this view always divides the world up into three sets. It's us, them, and the former us, the apostates. And these people are worse than animals. They're worse than anything out there because they're not human. They're devils themselves. They're influenced by the devil. They can't be trusted. Everything they say. This is why people ask all the time on online groups, and I've been asked the question myself 100 times, you know, what can I say to my family? Nothing. There's nothing you can say to them, because anything coming out of your mouth is a lie to them. It's all influenced by the devil. And the more sense you make, the more they'll just think that you're in Satan's power, because that's what sense, logic, science, reason are all tools of this grand demonic conspiracy. The only thing that's not is the authority of the church and your emotional connection to the authority of the church. Everything else is a lie. And the world they live in is such a scary place, because not only is it going to this ill-fated end, but also in their view, the devil's running everything. Absolutely everything. Monetary systems, governments, all the religions. We've backed away from our anti-Catholic rhetoric, but it's still there. Go down to DI and get yourself some Improvement Era magazines and read it from the 60s and 50s and earlier. To Mormons, for a lot of years, a Catholic mitre was just as well as having horns and a little Mike Norton beard.
Well, I was thinking, I mean, one of the reasons that I came down tonight is because I grew up in the 1980s, which was kind of the apex of the satanic heavy metal, and that's what we were into. I mean, we went to church. I was a true believer, but at the same time, I was fascinated with Black Sabbath and Iron Maiden and all this stuff, and it's almost like there's this symbiotic relationship where you can't really have the church unless you have that kind of stuff. You've got to have something out there that you can... Well, you were saying it before, point your finger at, but I think a lot of this kind of stuff, the heavy metal stuff, back then they marketed against that, and they used that to leverage, you know, their market share. Well, you know, we can... I don't know if you understand what I'm saying here. So now it's, you know, they've kind of gotten away with that, and it's all the sexual stuff and the Lady Gaga and that kind of thing. But...
You're just listening to the wrong station.
There becomes this, people can take advantage of the religious fundamentalism to market their own stuff.
I'm going to give you an assignment. You need to go home, go to YouTube, and you need to look up two bands. The first is Slipknot, and the second is Ghost.
You should.
One thing with, you were talking earlier about you can't convince your family because they think you're pretty much talking for the devil. Well, I kind of looked up a lot of stuff about from Mormons. I kind of got my information from Mormons. I couldn't remember what I used to believe. And they actually believe that he tries to imitate the work of God by transforming himself into an angel of light.
Yep.
So he is us. You know, our logic is being the devil because he imitates God. He deceives the whole, you know, everything. So, we're pretty much screwed in our family's life.
Yeah, and I've made the point recently many times that they can't tell the difference. Yeesh. If you're a Mormon, it's really scary.
Yeah.
I don't know how many of you have friends. I've got some close family members that are in because of the devil, because they felt, you know, y'all have your mission stories. They seem that a lot of them are because you felt this overwhelming darkness. And back to your point, John, is he that stupid to bear testimony or get you into the church by giving you those creepy feelings? I still am trying to figure out, and I've been in Mormonism for my whole life, what exactly are his powers? I was creeped out as a kid with Santa, knowing whether you were naughty or nice. That just really bothered me as a kid. I always was trying to figure things out, and finally I was relieved when I realized, okay, that's crazy, but it was just traded for a more... truly scary. He's not only everywhere, he's in my mind. One of my last meetings with the high priest was... We were talking about inspiration and how to, you know, get in the mood to feel the warm fuzzies. And I just said, you know, if we're inspired, can we be despired just as easily? In fact, or my question was, are our minds essentially open at any time? Do I have no control of other agents in the cosmos that their only goal in life is to destroy me? Is that really what we believe? And is that something we should be teaching our kids? Who, you know, so I had kids at that point that were going through puberty, and of course, you know, they're so confused, they don't know. But then on top of that, to say, not only are you messed up and confused and guilty, but really there are literally other agents able to get inside and not whisper to you in a demonic voice. They can take your own head, and they can represent themselves as you. What a total crazy, scary... Back to your point, what's the point of even making a choice or having free will if another evil agent can at any moment... Okay, so I'm going on and on. It's all nutty, but is Lucifer all-knowing? Does he's got some degree of powers, because I was always told he knows you better than you know yourself.
Oh, well,
he knows... That, you know, that button to push. Is he truly that smart but stupid enough to not say, hey, game over, I'm...
Well, you're absolutely right. The Mormonism and other fundamentalist faiths have elevated the devil to this really, this tons and tons and tons of power. Apparently more so than God has. But I want to go back to the point you're making before, because I think it's excellent and it's the place we need to be. What is the utility of all this? We've sort of described the system and said, oh, this is really sort of really fucky. Why is this around? Because you have it exactly right. The church talks about free will all the time, except they've introduced this system where free will is something that's only an abstraction, because every person is a worm, and you cannot tell the difference between the demonic conspiracy, your own thoughts and feelings, and God. So even though the church talks all the time about feeling things or getting us confirmation, doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is to obey church authority, because any thought that you have in your head can be wrong. And that's something that's hard to say directly. So you say it indirectly by basically boxing everybody in, telling them they have agency, telling them that they have these feelings, but then putting an entire system where none of that can be believed. Because what would happen if you felt good listening to a talk? It would confirm it. What would happen if you felt bad? It was the devil.
The devil, right? Getting in. Well, and you know, to the flip side of that, what if you go to church and you feel very underwhelmed, but go home and you're listening to Black Sabbath or, you know, Slipknot or anything else? Well, obviously the devil has you right now, because there's no way, if you're really in the right place, that would feel good to you.
Right. They've constructed a system where all possible outcomes confirm whatever they want.
It's functional schizos, basically.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, essentially, yeah. I mean, you can't trust yourself. You can only trust what is passed to you across the pulpit, right? That's really what it comes down to.
Oh, one of my other obligatory, I've been told, references is to 1984. Of course, the three phrases from the book, you know, war is peace, love is hate, and the third one. Memory is slipping.
Remember that the whole idea of the philosophies of the man.
Yeah.
And we know that's code speak for devil stuff. So everything outside of what the church tells you counts as philosophies of men. So it's all of it's out.
But you're missing the second half of the phrase, mingled with scripture. So even anything that's inside that doesn't confirm whatever it is you're being told by your authority right now. And missionaries know this very well. Mission presidents will oftentimes go off book all the time and make up their own bullshit. And missionaries just have to go along with it, you know? Because you don't have any evaluation criteria to say, this is of the devil, and this is not of the devil. Since the devil can fake any feeling, you can't rely on your feelings. But the abstract brilliance of the system to and this is where I'm going with the love is war. Look at something as simple as tithing. Mormons will tell you straight faced how everything they get in the church is free. They can go use the building at any time for free. They don't pay their bishop. He's free. That if they have to go down to the welfare farm and get canned beets, it's free. And meanwhile, they're writing out these enormous checks. They'll tell you that you know the truth of things by your feelings. But if those feelings don't verify the truth that they already know, then the feelings are false. It's this crazy, crazy thing, and it's fucking scary that these guys are walking around this way all the time. That who knows what they could do. And historically, we've seen it go really wrong. If you've seen, you know, you've seen like the rack or whatever, and those things are real. What's maybe metaphorically more real is the rack and drawing and quartering. That wasn't really that common because it was really easy to use manacles. Which is just a little bit of iron, and you just hang somebody by their arms until they pop out. And that's what was the more common thing to do. But thousands and tens of thousands of people under religious zeal fell prey to this. And it's really super scary.
And it's an underlying principle. I mean, there's back to Demon Haunted World again. There's a quote in here which comes from William Blackstone, who was a celebrated jurist, is what it says. But he wrote a thing called Commentaries on the Laws of England in 1765. And this is a quote: "To deny the possibility, nay, actual existence of witchcraft and sorcery is at once flatly to contradict the revealed word of God in various passages of both the Old and New Testament." If you're going to be a believer and have that as your background, you've got to acknowledge some of these. This world has to exist and has to be driving these things. So that's what even makes it scarier, is even when they get reasonable and start to see maybe how ridiculous some of this looks on the surface, it comes down to it is doctrinal. It's there. It is a part of the system, whether they like it or not.
Well, and I stopped believing in the devil before I stopped believing in God.
That's common.
Yeah.
And of course, the Book of Mormon tells us that the way you know that there is a devil is because the devil says there isn't a devil. And which is evidence clearly that there's no devil because I just said there's not. And only a devil would say that there is no devil. I think that's what the book says. All right, well, it's really scary stuff, but the reason that it's important to understand is I think Laura, as you pointed out, you get removed from this line of thinking, and it's hard sometimes even go back and say, oh yeah, I used to believe that. That's crazy. But I think it's important that when we deal with our believing family members and our believing friends, we have to cut them a little bit of slack because they're not going to listen. Because this system is so powerful once you accept it that it's impervious to breaking into the system unless you reject the whole system. And I think that's your point, that Laura, when you said that I lost the belief in the devil first, because as long as you believe that the devil's there and the devil has this level of power, it's really a bulwark against rejecting any of the other beliefs.
It's really difficult. I mean, I'm sure that you've
everyone in this room has probably heard the story of so-and-so who decided that they were going to go to the temple on this day, and they had planned it and planned it and planned it, and sure enough, that day came, and they went and got in their car to go to the temple, and they blew a tire out. Well, obviously, the devil didn't want them to go to the temple, so he came out because they knew they were going to do it. I mean, I don't remember where it came from. It's some folk story in Mormonism about somebody who talked about how he was going to go to the temple and this
kept
is back.
Smoking a cigarette or something like that.
Well, the story, yeah, it's like something stupid would happen every time. It was basically a comedy of errors. Like he would announce he was going to go to the temple, and this was back, you know, before modern times. Is you know, hop in his wagon with his horse and head out to the temple, but something would happen to keep him from going every time. So ultimately, he had to not announce to anyone he was going to the temple, and he just in his head knew he was going to go and got up that morning and got on his wagon and rode there as fast as he could as though all the devils of hell were chasing him because he believed they were, at least, you know, in the story.
And then he got there and it was the 2 weeks a year that it's closed for
him. Oh, that sucked when that
happened. That's probably the ending. If it's not, it should be.
Did any of you ever do the calculus that, all right, well, there's 6 billion people on the world and maybe there's been 10 times that many. So that means there's 60 billion. That means that a third of the host of heaven, half of that, 30 billion, that's 5 devils, 5 things for every one of us. But we're the choice generations. They're doubling up on us. So you're walking around a little entourage. But, you know, then you start thinking, these guys are really sort of ineffective, you know, because I still go do my home teaching 3 or 4 times a year.
Not only did that was taught in seminary, because most of the world is so wicked that your average person needs one devil hanging around them most of the time. Right. So, boy, you guys have got dozens around you. You got to watch out.
Whole armies of those little fuckers all chasing you around all the time. Yeah. Yeah. It must be really boring, you know? I don't know. They run out of things to do. Who was? I think it was Heber Kimball, maybe. I know it was one of the 12 on their mission to England, where they talked about going into a pub or something. You guys know this story? And they had the sight of them, and they could see the little spirits jump into somebody's body so they could taste the pint as it was going down. That I can buy. That I can buy. Go ahead.
That's a reasonable story. What I was going to just say is how there's kind of a residual of all of this. Even after you quit believing. So it was about, I think, 2005 or so that I was going to send in my resignation letter. And I typed it all up, and I tried printing it. This is before you could submit it via email, at least that I knew. And my printer wouldn't work.
Wait, you say a printer wouldn't work?
My printer would not
work.
Wait,
wait, wait. Was this a Windows machine?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, right. I need to get back to the church.
Right, right. So, no, well, the second part of it is a couple years later, when BYU had Dick Cheney give their graduation convocation, I went back, found the same letter, printer worked just fine. So maybe it was God that made it not work the first time.
God just wanted to make sure that he had you in with that batch of anti-Dick Cheney people, because God was trying to send a message to the church, obviously.
So I guess the bottom takeaway is, yeah, just be gentle with people around you. For one, this is a really hard system to break out of, and for two, they might pull the rack out sometime. And
they think you're the devil.
String you up, so be cautious.
Well said.
Any last-minute thoughts from the
panel? I'll keep my eye out because they're probably going to be after me soon enough.
Flip?
For me, the whole irony about this, that's just so great. And it's something that is plain. It's on the page. It's plain to see. But if you go back to Genesis 1 and 2, in the story, God lies to Adam and Eve, and the serpent tells him the truth. Because God says, if you eat this, you will surely die. And I've been told that in the Hebrew, it's not, you know, you'll die in some future date. It's immediate. You'll die. And Satan tells him, you'll be as the gods, knowing good from evil.
All right.
From the very beginning, the entire history of Christianity has got it upside down. God's the liar.
Yeah, God's just like Yoda.
You just blew my mind.
Go watch Star Wars again. Everything Yoda says is wrong. I don't know why he's such a revered puppet.
Because he was based off of Spencer W. Kimball, obviously.
And he, And he sounds kind of like Miss Piggy, too, so you got that. All right, well, as always, you can head out to the website. We will be starting another of our sessions for Whitefields on Mormon identity, or, well, not Mormon identity, on finding post-religious identity. If you're interested in being involved in one of those great sessions, you can email Lindsay at whitefieldseducational.org. Please don't send her your depraved, I mean.
Those go to John.
I was deprived on my mission. But others were depraved.
So send Lindsay your deprived stories, yes, to make up for all the depraved stories she's been getting this week.
All right. Randy, Laura, Jen, thanks again. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, John.
Good night.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John. Mormon Expression is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Visit us online at whitefieldseducational.org to find more about our current initiatives. Mormon Expression is recorded live in downtown Salt Lake on Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. If you're in the area, please come join us in the studio.